Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Laveau. Most accounts of World War II focus on battles fought in Europe and Asia. Few mention attempts to bring the war to the United States. An exception to the rule is Michael Dobbs' Saboteurs, which tells the fascinating story of an attempted German raid on America. Dobbs will be here in just a few minutes to fill us in. After that, Talking History regular Henry Butterfield Ryan returns to provide a historical parallel between President George W. Bush's attack on Iraq and Napoleon Bonaparte's invasion of Egypt just over 200 years ago. And our historical hoax master, Alex Berza, concludes the show with his recollection of a report in the New York Herald some 150 years ago that created panic in the streets of that city without making any pretense to being true. But first, let's take a look at some interesting, recent items of historical interest in the news. Rasputin, the Russian monk who became the confidant of Tsarina Alexandra and her husband Tsar Nicholas, was killed by a British agent, according to a documentary broadcast last month on the BBC. The documentary reported the findings of Richard Cullen, a retired Scotland Yard commander, and Andrew Cook, an intelligence historian who studied the official records of the 1916 assassination, but employed new forensic analysis to reach a conclusion that contradicts the widely held belief that the monk was murdered by disaffected Russian aristocrats. The assassin, they insist, was Oswald Rainer, a member of the Secret Intelligence Bureau who was working at the Russian court in St. Petersburg. Rasputin claimed to have mystical powers and the ability to cure the Tsar's son, who was suffering from hemophilia. But he also sought to broker peace between Russia and Germany in the early years of World War I. That, the British feared, would free 350,000 German troops then employed on the Eastern Front to fight the Allies in the West. In another intelligence matter, a four-volume account of the history of U.S. counterintelligence from the American Revolution to the 1990s is available to the public for the first time. The 1,500-page report, titled A Counterintelligence Reader, was prepared by the now-defunct National Counterintelligence Center, but never released. Its successor, the National Counterintelligence Executive, has reversed that decision and made it available online at www.fas.org. And finally, General Douglas MacArthur may have been wrong. Not all old soldiers just fade away. Some just keep coming back. Or at least that's the case of G.I. Joe, who has hit the big 4-0 and is the subject of a museum exhibit at the Intrepid Sea Airspace Museum in New York City. Hard to believe that G.I. Joe swaggered into the American consciousness in his battle fatigues in 1964 and is now old enough to become a collectible, with pieces ranging from $75 to $4,000. The exhibit displays 40 G.I. Joes, one for each year of his life. Never mind that Joe took a few years off after the Vietnam War. No Joes were manufactured from 1976 to 1982. Or that when he came storming back in the 1980s, he had shrunk back to less than a third of his original height. To middle-aged fathers with childhood memories to pass along to their children, this is too good to miss. The exhibit is scheduled to close on December 31st. Yet to come, an interview with Michael Dobbs, the author of Saboteurs, The Nazi Raid on America, Napoleon in Egypt, and the New York Zoo Escape. You're listening to Talking History. Shortly after America's entry into World War II, Adolf Hitler ordered a sabotage campaign against the United States to disrupt the production of tanks and airplanes and blow up bridges and railroads, one team landing on Long Island, the other in Florida. The story of their mission may be one of the most interesting but least well-known of the war, at least until now, in publication of Saboteurs, The Nazi Raid on America, by our guest this week, Michael Dobbs. Dobbs is a reporter for the Washington Post, where he spent much of his career as a foreign correspondent. His earlier books include Down with Big Brother, The Fall of the Soviet Empire, and Madeleine Albright, A 20th Century Odyssey. Welcome, Michael.
Good to be here.
Great. Where'd you discover this story?
I'd been hearing about it in the months leading up to 9/11. I'd come across an article about a very celebrated Supreme Court case during the war involving the question of whether or not saboteurs captured on American soil could be tried by military tribunals. And that got me going into researching this rather extraordinary story about eight saboteurs who landed here by U-boat 6 months after Pearl Harbor.
Let's start with your information. Where did you get the information then? If you found this referenced in your research, you had to do some research on both sides of the Atlantic. So let's talk about the German operation first.
Well, I actually began the research here in the United States, very close to my home in Washington. The National Archives in College Park are an extraordinary resource, and the repository, among other things, of captured German war documents and many of the FBI files, at least of their most celebrated cases. So most of the research I did within half an hour of my home into the FBI archives, into the captured German documents. But I also went to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's library in Hyde Park, New York. I visited some of the locations associated with this story, including Hitler's bunker in what used to be East Prussia. I went to Berlin, the saboteur training camp near Berlin, and also went to the places in the United States associated with the saboteurs, including New York, Chicago, and Jacksonville, Florida.
Were the records pretty much complete on this incident?
Well, this was one of the FBI's most celebrated cases. So they collected every scrap of documents. I'd say there must be about at least 100,000 pages of FBI materials. The saboteurs were all captured, and they were all interrogated intensively, and their interrogations run into tens of thousands of pages just by themselves. But then the FBI investigated all their movements here in the United States and everybody they'd come into contact with, and after the war ended, they also conducted some investigations in Germany. So it makes possible a very detailed account of exactly what happened.
Detailed and quite dramatic account, I think. You open your book talking about the origins of the plan, which you suggest were actually at the highest level, possibly even including Adolf Hitler. Tell us about that a bit.
Well, one of the documents in the National Archives here is a war diary of a man called Colonel Lehausen. Colonel Lehausen was the chief of the sabotage wing of the Abwehr, the German military intelligence. And in his war diaries, he talks about flying up to a small town in what was then Eastern Prussia, it's now Poland, to meet with Hitler and to get Hitler's final approval to go ahead with his plan. Hitler and some of his top aides, like Hermann Göring, were very worried about the long-term impact of America coming into the war, and they wanted to find some way of sabotaging American war industry. The chiefs of the Abwehr, including Lehausen and Admiral Canaris, who was the head of the Abwehr, later implicated in a plot to assassinate Hitler, had some doubts about the plan, but Hitler ordered them to go ahead nonetheless.
Now, the saboteurs, from what I can tell in the book, are all German-Americans. How did they end up on the German side? Did you ever answer that question?
Yes, they all came from very similar backgrounds. They'd all emigrated from Germany in the years immediately after World War I, when conditions in Germany were pretty terrible. Many of them had been associated with an organization called the German-American Bund, which was the American equivalent of the Nazi Party. They were Bund members here in the United States. And then when Hitler came to power in Germany in the 30s, and it became obvious that Germany was going to war, for various reasons, they went back to Germany. Some of them hadn't done at all well here in the United States. Some of them admired Hitler. Some of them left for purely accidental reasons. One of them ran away from his home in Chicago because he had just got his girlfriend pregnant and didn't want to marry her, and ended up by a chain of strange coincidences back in Germany, where he was pressed into this mission to come back to the United States as a saboteur.
What exactly was the saboteur's mission, and how were they prepared for it?
Well, the goal of the mission was to sabotage the American war industry, and particularly aluminum plants. Aluminum was the material used to make airplanes, and Hitler, and particularly Goering, the head of the German Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, feared that the United States would very shortly be producing huge number of airplanes and overwhelm the German Air Force. So their idea was to strike at the aluminum industry. And also, as a secondary target, they were going to strike at various transportation bottlenecks around the United States. But the primary target was the aluminum industry, which turns out to be fairly easy to sabotage. If you cut the power to an aluminum plant, the molten metal congeals and can put the plant out of action for a very long time. So the idea of the mission was not a stupid one. From Hitler's point of view, it was quite a sensible one.
And by your estimation, was security in the United States at that point advanced at all? Was there any expectation of sabotage?
Now, this is one of several parallels, I think, with the situation before and after 9/11. There was a kind of false sense of security in the United States. This was 6 months after Pearl Harbor, but the war really hadn't come at all to American soil. Americans were fighting in Asia, but life in America was going on pretty much as normal, and in particular, the coasts were not particularly well defended. There was a U-boat war going on in the Atlantic. U-boats were patrolling up and down the American coastline, picking off targets more or less at will, because American cities refused to impose a blackout. And the light from the cities was an excellent backdrop for the U-boat captains to pick off their targets. Also, there was very little patrolling of the coastline. The Coast Guard was undermanned, and what patrolling there was done by unarmed Coast Guards, just singly along the beaches, and they had no means of calling assistance if they ran into somebody.
Your description of their Atlantic crossing is fascinating, but for the sake of time, could you pick it up perhaps from their landing and tell us what they encountered in both of the landings on Long Island and in Florida?
Right, it took them 3 weeks to cross the Atlantic in these very small U-boats. One group landed in Amagansett, Long Island, and the other group landed in Ponte Vedra, Florida, 4 days later. The group that landed in Long Island were very unfortunate in that their U-boat, the place they chose to land, was about 200 yards from a Coast Guard station. They landed at 1 o'clock in the morning, and they just happened to run, very unfortunately from their point of view, into a lone Coast Guard patrol about 20 minutes after they landed. It was a very foggy night, and they saw a man with a flashlight coming through the mist who encountered them. They were meant to overpower anybody they ran into on the beach and send him back to the U-boat. But instead of doing that, they tried to bribe him and pay him $300 or $400 to get lost and run away, which he did, but he then raised the alarm. The other group in Florida, they landed with much less difficulty. There was no Coast Guard patrols to speak of in Florida at that time.
Tell me about the capture of each and what happened to them.
Well, the group that landed in Long Island, although the alarm was raised, they got away from the beach before the Coast Guard managed to seal off the beach, and they just walked inland to Amagansett Rail Station, took the first train, I think it was the 6:59, into Manhattan, where they spent some time in Manhattan. One of them then got cold feet, and he decided to report the case to the FBI. Called up the FBI first in Manhattan, where he was dismissed as a crank, then decided to take the train down to Washington and turn himself in to J. Edgar Hoover. Initially, the FBI didn't take him seriously, but eventually he found somebody who would talk to him, and he began spilling this extraordinary story to the FBI man, who incidentally is still alive. He's 92 years old. His name is Dwayne Traynor, and I interviewed him extensively for the book.
Interesting. And the Florida group?
The Florida group, they'd landed about 4 or 5 days later at exactly the time, actually, that the leader of the first group was speaking to the FBI. So with the information that he, his name is George Dash, gave to the FBI, the FBI was able to round up the members of both groups within a week or so. So they went to Chicago and New York, but the FBI was soon on their tracks and rounded up all 8 saboteurs within 2 weeks of them landing in the United States.
And what happened to them?
There was a very celebrated military tribunal, which, by the way, is the precedent for the military tribunals that the Bush administration is setting up to try Al-Qaeda suspects. And their defense lawyers defended them very vigorously, fought the case all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court heard a challenge of habeas corpus, but in a 2-day hearing, eventually sided with the government, and the military tribunal then sentenced all the saboteurs to death, but commuted the death sentences on the 2 saboteurs who decided to turn themselves in. 6 of them were executed, and 2 of them were sentenced to long prison terms.
Okay, well, obviously the case was well known in the United States, but did word get back to Germany, and what was the reaction in Germany?
It did. The reporters weren't allowed into the military tribunal, so they were allowed to the Supreme Court session. So a slightly twisted version of what had happened got out, very much controlled by what the government wanted to let the Germans know. The government wanted to try to convince the Germans that they'd been arrested on arrival. But I think Hitler got a pretty accurate report of what had indeed happened within several weeks of their arrests. He was able to put 2 and 2 together. And according to Lehausen, who visited him at his bunker in Prussia, he was furious about this outcome and said, "You should have used Jews for this operation."
Oh, boy. Well, final question. Let me take you back to a point you made right at the very start. You mentioned you located the story through your research on 9/11. Any connection there? Have we learned anything from this research you've done that might be useful in our looking at terrorism today?
Well, I think, as I said, the fact that there was a false sense of security, the country was unprepared for what happened, that's a clear parallel between these events and the events of 9/11. Also, the infighting within the government was vicious. J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI in particular wanted to take full credit for rounding up these saboteurs, shared very little information with other government agencies. There are parallels there. And there are also parallels in the way we deal with saboteurs. President Bush, when he was deciding what to do with the people suspected of operating for Al-Qaeda, set up military tribunals very much on the lines of the tribunal that had tried these saboteurs. In fact, the rules of procedure for the tribunal that will try the Al-Qaeda suspects was more or less taken verbatim from the rules of procedure used to try the Nazi saboteurs. The defense lawyers are following the same pattern. They're appealing to the Supreme Court. And I think the Supreme Court will also, although it's decided to hear the appeal, in the end, I think it's going to side with the government. So really, you get a sense of history very much repeating itself.
Very interesting. So a story so little known today becomes so important, and it is a dramatic story. You've done well in outlining it in the book. You've been listening to Michael Dobbs, the author of Saboteurs, The Nazi Raid on America, and this is Talking History. Our guest commentator this week, Henry Butterfield Ryan, suggests that American foreign policymakers should have studied the historical example of Napoleon Bonaparte before concluding that U.S. troops would be hailed as liberators in Iraq. Ryan is an associate of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University and a life member of Cambridge University's Clare Hall.
Here is a quiz. What Christian leader invaded a mainly Arab Muslim country to rid it of a tyrannical government? Or so he said. Here are some clues. He claimed his troops were not invaders but liberators. Furthermore, he had no argument with Islam, which he said he deeply respected. His forces, far superior technologically, easily defeated the defenders. He then set up councils of local inhabitants to help govern the country and even asked some of his former enemies to help out. He planned major aid projects to modernize this economically underdeveloped society, hoping also that his country's ideals would take root and spread in the region. The population accepted his troops quietly but sullenly, and within a few weeks a guerrilla war broke out, led by members of the former regime, with followers who resented the Christian occupation. Meanwhile, his campaign was highly controversial at home, and many of his troops wanted to leave a place they came to hate. But no one had yet considered an exit strategy. The man was Napoleon Bonaparte, who led a French army into Egypt in 1798 to overthrow the Mamluks, rulers of Egypt for centuries. There are plenty of differences between the French in Egypt and the Americans in Iraq. Nevertheless, the similarities are remarkable and worrisome. In 1799, the year after the invasion, difficulties in Europe caused Napoleon personally to leave Egypt. Without his guidance, the French occupation faltered, something that could happen in Iraq even more than it has, if Washington's attention, like Napoleon's, focuses elsewhere. If that seems unlikely now, we should remember how we slipped away from involvements with the South Vietnamese in the 1970s, the Afghans in the 1980s, and the Iraqi Shiites after our first war in Iraq in the 1990s. In Egypt, Great Britain, having already destroyed Napoleon's fleet, joined the Turks to force the French out. The French, by now happy to leave, agreed to go if the British would take them and their weapons home, which the British did. Chaos reigned for 4 years after the French left Egypt, and then a worse tyranny than that of the Mamluks emerged, that of Muhammad Ali. The same could happen in Iraq. American policymakers should study Napoleon's Egyptian experiences. Had they done so earlier, they might not have expected to be hailed as liberators in Iraq, and might have calculated more accurately the forces they would need.
You've been listening to Henry Butterfield Ryan, an associate of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University and a life member of Cambridge University's Clare Hall. When we return, Alex Berza tells us about another of his hoaxes in history. This is Talking History. We conclude this week's program with another historical hoax from the files of Alex Berza. Berza is the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium. This week, Berza reports on the New York Zoo escape.
On November 9, 1874, the front page of the New York Herald warned in breathless prose that the animals had escaped from their cages in the New York Zoo and were rampaging through the city. A lion had been seen inside a church. A rhinoceros had fallen into a sewer. A tiger had leapt onto the 23rd Street ferry. The police and National Guard were heroically battling the beasts, but already 27 people were dead and 200 injured. It was a bloody and fearful carnival, the article despaired, and the animals were still on the loose. Many readers panicked when they read the article. Armed men swarmed into the streets, ready to defend their homes. Parents kept their children locked inside. relatives outside of the city frantically telegraphed to see if their loved ones were okay. Of course, those who panicked hadn't read to the end of the article, where it stated quite clearly that, quote, "the entire story given above is a pure fabrication." But then who would sit and calmly read a newspaper if you thought that wild animals were about to burst into your house? The author of the piece was a reporter named Joseph Clark, who wrote it in collusion with his editor, Thomas Connery. Clark and Connery later claimed that they hadn't really intended to fool anyone. They had simply wanted to draw attention in a dramatic way to the dangerous conditions at the zoo that they thought were a disaster waiting to happen. They said they were as shocked as anyone when the article provoked such an enormous reaction. But they didn't seem very repentant. By way of apology, they inserted a short statement into the next issue of the Herald, urging that safety precautions at the zoo be improved. And in response to criticism from the New York Times, they argued that the editor of the Times was simply mad because he had fallen for the hoax. They noted that he had been seen running out of his home waving two pistols in the air and berating the police for not doing more. The public itself, oddly enough, didn't seem that angered once the initial commotion had worn down. Not a single person canceled their subscription, and in the days following the panic, the circulation of the Herald actually increased. So the final lesson that everyone took away from the incident was not that conditions at the zoo were dangerous, but rather that hoaxes were remarkably good for the newspaper business.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes and the curator of the virtual museum of the same name, available to you at www.museumofhoaxes.com. That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beattie, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.